Welcome. This is Jacqueline Machard, and this is Jacqueline Machard's Summer Scribes series. I am a writer, and I love talking to writers, and I love talking about books, probably more than anything. And today I'm really lucky to have a writer with me who has written an absolutely wonderful first novel, of which I am the editor. So he's my discovery, though I'm sure that he would consider himself a person in his own right. Anyway, I want you to welcome Dean Gloster, who is the author of Dessert First, which is published by Merit Press. Hello, Dean. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks.
Well, I knew when I first read the first pages of Dessert First that it would be a wonderful novel, but I'm going to just, I hope not embarrass you, but read two snippets from two reviews about this book and its wonderful heroine, Kat, from Kirkus Reviews, a notoriously mean reviewer who just got all sentimental and joyous reading this book. Kat is wise, dependable, and loving, a beautifully realized character, a deeply moving tragedy. And from the School Library Journal, a sweet, sorrowful, and simply divine debut novel that teens will be sinking their teeth into. This wonderful story will be a hit with fans of John Green's The Fault in Our Stars. Well, you always knew it was good, right, Dean?
Well, I thought it was good, and as I rewrote and went through the editing process, it got better.
Well, you are a person who doesn't like to give up easily. Let's put it that way. You have a diverse background. You were a lawyer, and you clerked for Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, and then Supreme Court Justice Byron White, and you traveled as a freelance writer through Asia, but most importantly to me, you were a stand-up comic.
Yes, doing stand-up comedy is great training for anything else you do in life, because anything is actually easier than going on at 1 in the morning at the Holy City Zoo to a small number of surly drunks. So it's great training for other things in life.
Including book reviews and facing book reviewers and mean editors. So I have heard that your editor was extremely nice.
That's what I heard, too. That was my experience.
I want to ask you to tell the listeners just a little bit about Dessert First, a wonderful title for a story that truly is heartbreaking, but also in an ironic fashion, inordinately life-affirming. This is a story about a kid with cancer and his beloved and much-loving older sister, who has been successful at so much in her life but cannot be successful at the things she wants to do most. So can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, it's the story of a 16-year-old girl, Kat Monroe, who's been struggling with some issues at school and in friendships. And then her younger brother, Beep, is diagnosed with a relapse of his leukemia. And she is the bone marrow donor to try to save her younger brother. And one of the things that was interesting to me about the story was she's a parentified child. So she's trying to take care of people and take care of the other members of her somewhat dysfunctional family, and it's really a little beyond her. And so she's trying to deal with all of these things, and underneath it all, she's got some anger, which comes out in her sense of humor. And so it, in many ways, was a really fun story to write, although there are a couple of very tearjerker scenes.
She has been her family's, I guess in one review or one description I read, she has been the family's cheerleader. And when she can't succeed at the things that maybe she really wants most to do, that dark sense of humor is in part her salvation. But what else is? I mean, I guess at the bottom of every tragedy is the message somehow that when the sun sinks, we are all we have in the dark.
Right, and I think in the book, she thinks her sense of humor will save her, and it turns out that's not actually the case. You know, in the end, she has to forgive some other people and ultimately forgive herself and reconnect with other people so that ultimately she finds her salvation in finding a way to reconnect with her older sister and with her friends and to let other people back into her life.
Your wife, if I remember correctly, is a pediatric oncology nurse, or has been. Is that correct?
Yes, she was for years a pediatric intensive care unit nurse at UCSF Hospital, where some of the book takes place. And now she actually works at the palliative aquatic program at a children's hospice and respite care facility, the George Mark Children's House.
And so how did her work and when we watched the Olympics, we heard that behind every one of those great swimmers was a great husband or wife. How did some of the work that she did help inspire this story?
Well, it's really striking when you live with someone who works in a children's hospice. You know, you get these incredibly heartbreaking stories, but the mission of a hospice is really interesting. They're not trying to cure disease. They're trying to take care of people at the most difficult time there is, which is when people are losing a child. So their mission is to take care of the child and to take care of the family and to really deal with vulnerable people at the most painful time in life. So I think a lot of that really informed the book that I was writing, because it's about a sibling and a family dealing with this incredibly hard stuff.
Have you ever read, a pal of mine, Laurie Moore, wrote a wonderful story called People Like That Are the Only People Here, really a novella, I guess, about pediatric intensive care and pediatric oncology based on an experience that she had. And one of the lines from that story, I really was asking you if you had read it, that was that courage requires options, and the people who are there really don't have any options. So you can't really say, oh, they're so brave.
Right. I have not read that. But, you know, it's interesting. People adapt, and we're extraordinary creatures. I think I'm always struck by, I don't know if you remember back on September 11th, there was a flight 83, that got hijacked. And the people on board decided they were just going to take the plane back. And it's a bunch of strangers who, in any other circumstance, would be really annoyed by a one-hour flight delay, and they decided to storm the cabin, and because they didn't have another option. So they just – people do extraordinary things when they're called on to do extraordinary things.
People always ask me, because I write novels as well, and people always ask me – they say to me, you're a funny person. You know, why don't you ever write a happy story? And I do write stories that I write stories in which there is all kinds of happiness and certainly all kinds of humor. But as I tell people, there are really no great novels about going to Florida for a vacation in which everything went right and all the meals were good and nobody lost their luggage. There has to be some kind of conflict in a story. And it has to be an important conflict with high stakes in order to make that story a good story. And I think of Dessert First not necessarily as, I mean, it is a tragic story, but in a sense it affirms everything that is worthwhile about hanging in there.
Well, thank you. And one of the reasons I really like writing YA and reading YA is that the stories typically end with a note of hope. And so one of the nice things about reading YA is, you know, that you will read about sometimes a very dark subject or a difficult thing, and it's likely to end with a note of hope and positivity. So
are you following
doing that.
Teenage kids around with a tape recorder? Because I had and I don't mean that in a stalker way. I interviewed an agent last week on this series, and he said, in YA and indeed in all novel writing, it's all about the voice, and the voice in this story is just spot on. I have two daughters who are 17, and it could not be more accurate. So how did you achieve that? Because I don't think you're 17 or 16 even.
No, but the voice was very easy for me because I do have a sense of humor and because I had a lot of anger at 16, and it came out in a sense of humor, and it didn't always serve me with my peers. And so that voice was very easy to find. And so the character's voice came to me, and that's why I could never give up on this novel, which is I just loved Kat's voice, and I really enjoyed it so much.
But also,
in many ways,
she's a girl, and you're a fella. How did you enter the extraordinarily, I don't know, I guess both dark and sunny and egoistic realm of a girl?
Well, I had for many years coached girls' soccer, so
oh.
I closely observed them under stress, and then, you know, people often ask male writers, how did you manage to get a female voice correctly, and they don't often ask female writers how they got a male writer's voice accurately. I think it's part of humanity, just paying attention.
I always tell my kids that genius, that paying attention is another word for genius. But it isn't true. People always ask me, like in my most recent novel, Two of By Sea, I was writing from the point of view of a guy who's 40 years old, and people did say that to me. They said, kind of, how dare you? Why did you set out to write from the point of view of somebody that you've never been and you're quite likely never going to be? But I think that there are certain human experiences and tragedy and joy and I guess loving another person are universal. And the rest is, as they say, in the details.
Absolutely. And, you know, frankly, one of the joys of writing fiction is to step into a character who is different than yourself and try to understand them and to get that voice.
Well, I said that you had a checkered past, but you also have a checkered present. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about that I happen to know about is that you have a weird hobby, downhill ski racing in the winter, and that it's had some consequences for you. And I don't mean crossing the finish line in front of everybody else, but some other kinds of consequences, and you still do it. Why?
Well, I've broken a few bones, but only one at a time. And I love to ski race. It's incredibly fun, and it wonderfully concentrates the mind. So everything, the worries and the to-do list and the inner monologue goes away when you're skiing at 65 miles an hour on a Super G course and catching air.
Wow.
It's very zen, so it's wonderful.
How long does it take to complete? I know races are different, but how long does it take to complete one of those? Just a minute, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, and some of the courses are shorter than that. So you'll have at the NASCAR National Championships, often the courses are about 30 seconds long. So it happens very fast.
I have to confess, though, I do like you. I'm very jealous of you because you're a full-time writer now. And that is a dream that many of the people who listen to this podcast and who are starting out as writers would absolutely love to realize. But also this guest host who has, 40 jobs is also jealous of that ability to just concentrate on the art of writing. So tell me about that.
Well, I was a lawyer for decades, and I saved my money. And so I saved and saved and saved. And then my daughter decided to leave college and become an environmental activist before I expected. And I suddenly realized that retiring to write, which had been my dream, was closer than I thought. And so I went part-time at work for 2 years to finish that novel and found that I just absolutely loved writing. And, I was doing what I had always wanted to do with my life, and that's kind of an extraordinary gift when you get to do what you want.
Are you at work on another novel?
Yes, I'm deeply into the next novel, and it's quite fun because instead of one narrator, it's got three narrators, and so I have to have a different voice for each of those three.
Can you tell us anything about, just a little teaser about what the idea is or the inspiration behind it, anything like that?
Well, it's kind of fun. It's a little offbeat because it's magical realism, and it all takes place in one night in San Francisco. And I guess when I try to describe it in a nutshell, it's Nick and Nora's infinite playlist in the Twilight Zone. So there's a young woman who actually has a brain tumor, and she's trying to figure out what to do because her current personality is actually an artifact of the brain tumor. And so removing the tumor actually means she goes back to how she was before, and she doesn't want to do that. So she's facing some complicated decisions.
Now, is this a young adult novel also, or is this an adult novel?
It's a young adult novel. It's sort of right on the edge because the protagonist is 18.
Okay. There's something else I want to ask you about. You're an accomplished writer. That is to say, you're a very good writer, and now you're a published writer. But you're also studying in a Master's of Fine Arts program to get a degree as a master writer, I guess. Tell me what goes into that. Why did you decide to go to an MFA program to study?
Well, it's one of the two best decisions I've ever made in my life. I just lucked out incredibly well. I'm at Vermont College of Fine Arts in their program for writing for children and young adults. And I'm a grown-up, and I thought, if I'm going to go back to school, there's a certain amount of academic BS that one has to deal with that, and I'm not sure this will work because I don't really do that. But what I found was the program is terrific, and I've learned so much, and my classmates are just so wonderful, and it's like in my 50s finding my tribe. So it's a wonderful thing, and I've learned so much. I am learning so much.
But for so many people, those kinds of educational or adventures are not as, how do I say this, not as pure as you've conceived it, because you're there really for the skill and the enrichment of the skill, not to get a stamp necessarily that's going to allow you to move on to the next thing.
Right, and the program fits that extremely well because they really concentrate on craft. And one of the nice things coming from a ski racing background is that ski racers and writers are very similar. you learn a ton from each other, and you all face the same issues. You know, ski racers, you have to get forward, and you have to trust your outside ski, and you have to worry about hand position, and writers need to show, not tell, and have terse dialogue. And so there's a bunch of things that all of us struggle with, and we can learn from each other. And
you also have to be reckless and ignore the evidence that you could fall down and smash yourself. I mean, writers have to ignore the evident proof that they might not get published and people might not like the things that they read, but they still want to hurtle downhill toward the goal of writing a novel. There are more obvious parallels even than the ones you mentioned.
Yeah, you have to have courage and you have to push the edges of your comfort zone. To make progress, you actually have to try something that's different than last time.
My daughter gave me a T-shirt for my last birthday, and on the front she said, "This is your motto. This is what you always told us." But it was two different things, and I think it relates to me being a writer. And on the front it said, "Be brave and try to be good." And on the back it said, "Be good and try to be brave." And I guess that about nails it.
Those are great slogans.
Aren't they? Tell me about the writers you admire. Tell me about who inspires you. And I guess I'm not going to ask you what's on your nightstand right now. I'm going to ask you what is on your sort of golden hits nightstand in terms of the writers and craftspeople that you admire in the world of books.
Well, I read a tremendous amount of young adult fiction, and some of the writers who I absolutely love and the specific books, I love A.S. King, and I love Please Ignore Vera Dietz, and she's got chapters that are narrated by a pagoda and the narrator's dead friend Charlie, and some chapters that are actually in the form of flowcharts from Vera's father, and it's just extraordinary. It works, you know, that's just tremendous, and every book A.S. King writes is different from the book she wrote before, and that's wonderful. And E. Lockhart wrote a book, The Disreputable History of Frankie Landau Banks, and I just, the voice of the protagonist and then the voice of this sort of distant, almost stuffy narrator over the top of that is wonderful, and she is such a fierce girl and so insistent on being a person and not just someone who can be ignored.
Lockhart also wrote We Were Liars, didn't she?
Yes, she did. She did.
Oh, I love that book.
And then I love Patrick Ness's A Monster Calls. That book just tore me up, which it was just extraordinary.
So, and what's your favorite adult book? I assume you read those as well.
I do read those, and, you know, there are so many that are so good, so it's a little hard to pick one.
That's... Okay. Just pick one, though. I mean, it doesn't have to be your favorite, but pick one that you love and that you consider important for writers to read. I have one that I always think of as important for all people who would write to read, and that is True Grit by Charles Portis,
which
I think of as a wonderful novel with a beautiful sense of voice, and though it's very short, it's terribly precise and genuine.
It's a wonderful book, and when they remade the movie, they actually used the good dialogue from the book instead of what had gone on before. So that was
indeed
they actually did a good job when they remade the movie of actually taking the good dialogue from the book. That's an excellent book. I loved The Great Gatsby, and I really admired, I had tried to write a book once where the protagonist was less interesting than a young woman who was a friend of hers, and so it's a complicated thing to write a book where the narrator is almost a secondary character. And so I really thought The Great Gatsby absolutely worked on that front.
Yeah, that was it was masterly. People can't even remember until they really think about it. They can't even remember the name of the narrator. They
right.
can only remember the larger than life and larger than death personalities that narrator wrote about. Okay. Now, before I ask you my penultimate question, which is one of my favorite questions, I want this show to appeal to people who write as well as people who read. Do you have a set routine for writing? I know that this is a tedious question. People ask me this question all the time, and I have a different answer every time I answer it. But do you treat writing like going to work at the bank and you work every day from 9 to 3 or something like that?
Well, my schedule varies more than that, but I like to do creative writing in the morning. I think I have more energy in the morning, and if I make progress on creative writing in the morning, it just works better, and then I can revise in the afternoon. So I like writing new stuff in the morning.
And about how long did it take you to write Dessert First?
It took me forever.
Really?
Oh, my heavens. It took 8 years or 9 years because, first, I had no idea how to write a novel, and so I had to learn as I went, and I had to completely change the format of the novel long, long, long before you saw it. And then in the middle of that process, you know, the book involves a brother with cancer, and in the middle of that process, my brother got diagnosed with very serious cancer, and until he went into remission after chemo and radiation and surgery, I couldn't work on the book. So I had to set it aside for some time.
Wow. I hope he's doing okay.
He's doing great, and he's still in remission, and things are going well, which is why I got that book finished.
It seems sometimes, and I don't know how this functions, that life and art, writing and real life, are tangled up together in ways that could only be explained by some sort of, magical realism connection. And though I don't believe in things like that, it's almost as though our writer selves have some kind of interior prompt from the universe, because those things get tangled up all the time.
I agree.
I want to ask you. Yeah, go ahead, please.
I agree, and it sometimes seems too, when I'm trying to figure out issues in my life, I can work backward from the issues I'm writing about. You know, it your subconscious is picking these topics for a reason.
I agree. That's exactly what I should have said. I agree with it. I agree with everything you said about that, because it's almost as though we have some sort of trunk line to an unobserved universe. So last thing I'm going to ask you, because we only have a minute left, is my favorite question. What's your favorite word? And I'll give you a second to think. I'll tell you what my favorite word is. My favorite word is the same word that Emily Dickinson said was her favorite word, and that's Massachusetts. And it isn't even, it's a name, you know, it's not even a word. I have other favorites, but that's one of my very favorite words, and she said that was a word to conjure with. It's one of my favorite words to say. What's your favorite?
Well, I'm not sure. Evanescent is a incredibly word, and then subtle is a nice word. And if you want to say something funny, the word duck always works. You know, that's the funniest animal is duck.
Ah, I didn't even think of that. Anyway, this has been Jacqueline Michard, Scribes of Summer, and our guest has been Dean Gloster, whose book Dessert First is published by Merit Press, much to our pride. And thank you for being with us today, Dean.
Thank you.
Take care now. Bye.